Today's topic is the lattice quantum gauge theory. So we are changing completely the type of quantum many-body system that we are considering. And in order to understand our motivation to do so, let us make a sketch that summarizes the main things that we have understood so far. So we have seen that in quantum many-body theory we have a mechanism called symmetry breaking such that some global symmetries can be broken in the ground state. And this has two consequences. So if the symmetry is broken, so this is important, this is a global symmetry. If the symmetry is broken, then we have a degeneracy. And we have non-vanishing expectation values of local operators. And we have long range order. And this can be also, this can be the connector or the non-connected correlation function, depending on the cases. And we also have learned something that if we have, we don't have all of this, but we have a unique ground state plus a gap. So we have this situation, this is our ground state. Here we have all the other states. We have a gap delta here. Then instead, our connected correlation functions have to decay exponentially. So the picture of the quantum world that we have learned is that we can classify quantum phases using their symmetry. So we consider the symmetries of every possible symmetry that a Hamiltonian can have. So this would be the symmetry one. Then this would be the symmetry two, and so on and so forth. And inside each symmetry, we have a different pattern of breaking the symmetry in the ground state. So we have residual symmetries inside here. And we know that these changes of symmetry breaking are associated with the critical phenomena. Namely, for instance, the closure of a gap or long range fluctuations at the critical point and all this critical or the blowing up of the quantum geometric tensor. So this is the picture that we have so far. And we have commented that if we completely disregard the symmetry, then I could go from any state to any other state because I'm not stuck in some symmetry. without encountering a phase transition. Insofar we don't care what is the symmetry, all these states are similar. The only thing that distinguishes a ferromagnetic state from a paramagnetic state is that one doesn't break Z to symmetry, whereas the ferromagnetic state breaks Z to symmetry. If we don't care about this difference, then they are in the same phase. Because a phase is an equivalence class. So whether two states are in the same phase or not depends on what is this equivalence. If we consider equivalent all the states that break Z to symmetry, then all the ferromagnetic states are in one phase, and all the paramagnetic states are in another phase. And they are not connected. But if we disregard symmetry, so we don't care about the Z to symmetry, well, then of course there is a path in the parameter space in which there is no symmetry, Z2, in which they are connected. We do not encounter any quantum phase transition. Okay, so this is the picture of the world we have. It has been extremely successful. But then we have, and in fact it was not challenged until I think 1984, when something experimental happened, that was that 2D electron gases, two-dimensional electron gases at very low temperature and in the presence of very strong magnetic field showed critical behavior. So there were quantum phase transitions, but there were never a change of symmetry in any of these different ground states. So how is it possible? But actually, this picture of the world could have been challenged already on a theoretical basis. And the theoretical basis is the following. Imagine that I have two states, psi 1 and psi 2. So given my Hilbert space, I have any two quantum states. And so question one, is there always a unitary operator that connects them? The answer is yes, you know that. Okay. Question two, is there always an Hermitian operator H such that is the log of this, or in other words, U is e to the minus I H What do you think is the answer? Yes. Yes. So there is always a Hamiltonian such that any state is the ground state of some Hamiltonian, and such that I can deform continuously one state in another by changing slowly the Hamiltonian. This is called Stone theorem, I believe. And it's an interesting result in the theory of linear operators. Okay, so now the question is, are all these Hamiltonians labeled by symmetry? So is it possible that I have a state that lives here? So if I can use any Hamiltonian that I want, then definitely I can connect, this is what we just said, we can connect all the states in the Hilbert space. But if I impose all the possible symmetries of a Hamiltonian, do we break something or not? So in other words, do these breakings only come from symmetry, or there are other things? And today, in the two lectures of today, we'll understand that there are other things. So in order to do that, so this is the motivation of the quantum lattice gauge theory. Which is a quite weird thing. So, what is a gauge theory in quantum mechanics? If you remember, I think from the first lecture, we made an example of two physical systems. One was H1, that was the set of axes with x real number, is the Hilbert space of a particle on a line, and H2, that was x mod a with x real number, and this is the Hilbert space of particles on a circle of length a. And we notice that if we define the translation operator Ty as the operator that associates x plus y to x, we notice that this operator does two different things in these two Hilbert spaces. So when I translate by A, because in this Hilbert space, Ta on psi is equal to some other state, psi prime, that is at a length A away from the initial one. But in this case, it goes into itself, right? Because it's a circle. So Ta is very different. So if I choose a Hamiltonian for this system, now I decide what is the Hamiltonian of the system, I must choose a Hamiltonian such that H and T commute, right? Because if H and T do not commute, what would it mean? Would it mean that the expectation value of the energy in this state is different from the expectation value of the energy in this state. But they are the same state, so this is not possible. So this is a constraint given by the structure of the Hilbert space. So all this structure, the Hilbert space with the Hamiltonian that has to obey this constraint, is called the gauge structure. Of course, nobody forbids me to use this Hamiltonian also for this Hilbert space. And again, this will not change the fact that these two operators commute. However, now this has a completely different physical meaning. We are saying that the energy of this state is the same energy of this state. Or that, you know, the Hamiltonian doesn't, the energy doesn't care if you shift your state of a length A. It's a symmetry. This is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So as you can see, there is no gauge symmetry. People use this word gauge symmetry, but there is no symmetry. these two things have two completely different meanings. You can keep using the words gauge symmetry as long as you know it does not have this meaning. Because these are two completely different facts. Very good. So now that we know what is a symmetry in quantum mechanics, a gauge symmetry in quantum mechanics, namely, it's not a symmetry, it's a structure that allows us to identify some states starting from a larger Hilbert space. Right? You see what we did here? We started from a very large Hilbert space of the infinite line, and then we took a segment in here, we glued it, and we build a different Hilbert space in which there is this gauge structure. H2 is what we call the gauge invariant Hilbert space. Namely, because of the fact that the states in this Hilbert space are invariant under the transformation. So that's why they're called gauge invariant Hilbert space. These names are a bit misleading because it looks like we are discovering again that states in this Hilbert space have some property of being gauge invariant, which is, you know, literally speaking true, but it's really the way we have defined the gauge invariant Hilbert space. It's this structure of identifying different states that have different labels, but they are the same quantum state. Okay, now we want to do a gauge theory, a quantum gauge theory for a many-body system. And as usual, we like to use some graph, right? Because the graph is the structure that tells us how spatially related are the different many-body degrees of freedom in our Hilbert space. So that's why we call this quantum lattice gauge theory. And we call it lattice gauge theory just because the lattice is a regular graph, right? It's a nice regular graph, so we do not have theory. We do not have to worry about specific properties of the graph. So let us introduce a 2D square lattice. Okay. And it is not necessary to do so, it's just much more convenient for explanations. Let us place some degrees of freedom on the bounds of the lattice. Like here, I mean, every link of the lattice will have a degree of freedom. Okay? So our local Hilbert space is associated to the link L. Okay? I'm not putting the Hilbert space on the nodes. And we can choose that to be the simplest Hilbert space that we know, our beloved C square. Spin 1/2, two states. Let us also pick periodic boundary conditions. So we have periodic boundary conditions on our lattice lambda. So do you know what happens when you take a square and you choose periodic boundary conditions? What do you get? You get a torus. So this lattice actually looks like something like this. And it's wrapped all around the torus. Okay. And let us also say that our lattice is L by L. So we have L nodes in this direction and L nodes in this direction with periodic boundary conditions. Okay. Now I'm very interested in knowing what is the dimension of the Hilbert space H lambda, which is, as we know, the tensor product of all these ones. Right? We have all these spins, and then we take the product of all of them, and we have our total Hilbert space. Well, the dimension of this, as we know, will be equal to 2 to the number of spins. And if you have taken chemistry, you know that with the periodic boundary conditions on a square of L by L, there are two L square links. Right? Because, well, I'll let you do that. Or remember what you did in chemistry. Okay. So, do we agree that this is the dimension of the Hilbert space? Now, this is the equivalent of our Hilbert space H1. Okay? It's the total Hilbert space. We have all these labels. Each label corresponds to a degree of freedom. And now we want to invent a gauge structure. Okay. So we need to do something similar to what we did above. We need to invent some transformation. Let me call it A. Such that A psi is my transformed state when I apply this transformation. It's like our TA. And then we would like to call the gauge invariant Hilbert space the set of states such that this is so. Notice that even above, I could have simply said, that H2 is nothing else but the states in H1 such that Ta psi is equal to psi. Right? So I want to do the same thing here. And so let's define this transformation. So let me, from now on, label the sides of the lattice by some vector n. Okay? So notice that in a square lattice, of course, we have 4 links coming out of a site n. And let me define my local transformation as applying sigma x on each of the spins that live on these links, right? Remember that there is a spin on each link. And I will use this notation. This is the product for all the links that belong to n of sigma x L. So this transformation, I call it A of n. It's a local transformation. You see? It only operates on 4 spins that are localized at n. And now I will define my gauge invariant Hilbert space in this way. So H gauge will be equal to the states in the parent Hilbert space H lambda, such that A n psi is equal to psi for every n. So you see that we did define this Hilbert space exactly like in this example. It's the same thing that we did. Notice also that this is a non-trivial definition, because let me pick some state in here. Okay? Let's say 0 0 0 1 1 0 0 1 1 0 0, so on. Okay? This is a state in this Hilbert space, right? This is the first spin, the second spin, the third spin. I'm saying if it's up or down. And now let me apply An here. So what is An? It's four sigma x operators that are acting on four spins somewhere in the lattice. Namely, say these four spins are these four. An acts here. So this belongs to n. Well, then the state would change from this state to the state with 1, 1, 0, 0. Right? This is what the sigma x operator does. So definitely, this state does not belong to H gauge. So this is not a trivial definition. Some states will belong to H gauge, hopefully. It could be an empty Hilbert space. But definitely not all of them. In fact, the same example works for every state in the computational basis. No state in the basis of sigma z is like that. Okay. Other remark. Mathematically, this transformation that we'll call gauge transformation, local gauge transformation, is such that, as you can see, An square is the identity. We are used to the fact that every time our operators are just products of our sigma variables, they always square to the identity. Right? This is just sigma x, sigma x, sigma x, sigma x. The square is the identity. So this means that there is a local group that contains the identity and An. As you can see, this set is a group. It contains two elements, and products of them stay in here. It's the group with two elements, abelian group with two elements, which is called Z2. So because our local gauge transformations are Z2, from now on, this is going to be the quantum lattice Z2 gauge theory. The simplest possible gauge theory, because Z2 is the simple possible group, just like C2 is the simple possible Hilbert space. So 2 is the simplest interesting number that we have. With only one object, we cannot do anything. But with 2, we can do a lot of stuff. Okay. Let me change blackboard. And now we would like to, first of all, make sure that this H gauge is non-empty. Right? Maybe there is no state in there. And in fact, we not only we want to show that it's non-empty, we want to show that it is still quite big. So in other words, we want to compute the dimension of H cage. How big is this space? How many states there are? Of course, there are, in a vector space, there are always infinite states. How many states there are in a basis? We need to find a basis. So notice that this procedure is equivalent to making a projection. Okay? So we have a large Hilbert space, our H lambda, and then there is a projection operator that projects from this Hilbert space to a smaller space that is H gauge. We want to see this as a projection. Okay? How do we see it as a projection? Notice that since a square is 1, then the operator an has two eigenvalues, plus 1 and minus 1. Has two different eigenvalues, plus 1 and minus 1. Right? So if I require that these are all the states such that this is invariant, I'm saying that all the states must be eigenvectors of an with eigenvalue plus 1. Whereas, in general, I could have all the possible eigenvalues for a state. No? So I could have also the eigenstates of A with eigenvalue minus 1. So every time I say, so let me pick n, I say, for this an, my states, my basis states, must have eigenvalue plus 1. Well, then I am saying, oh, instead of having a basis in which this could be an eigenvector, eigenvalue plus 1 or minus 1, I only have plus 1. So I have divided the dimensionality of my Hilbert space by 2. Right? Because for every choice of an, before I had two possibilities, now I have only one. So every time I fix one of these constraints, I divide by 2. So we are projecting onto the Hilbert space of states in which all these constraints are true. What is this projector? Let me write it here. So the projector Pn that projects me onto the subspace where this is true. Solution to this problem is this. So let's show it. So first of all, we need to show that Pn is a projection operator. Namely, that Pn squared is equal to Pn. And this is quite obvious. Right? If you square this, you see it doesn't take much. Okay? You would have 1 plus 1 when you square this, plus 2a. Divide everything by 2, and we get this again. The other interesting thing is that if I take some state and then I project it, then if this is the projector onto this subspace, now this state must be invariant under an. So we need to show that this state is again Pn psi. Right? Well, but notice that an Pn psi is equal to, so an times Pn is again Pn, right? Because an times the identity is an, and an times an is the identity. So an on Pn psi just give me Pn psi. Oh, so this is true. So this is the projection onto this space. So if I do it for every n, the projection onto H gauge, large P, so this is equal to large P H lambda, where large P is nothing but the product of all this Pn. Do you agree? So H gauge is, let me write it again, is the product of all these projectors, so let me write it explicitly, times my total Hilbert space. So this is my gauge invariant Hilbert space. And we know that every time we do a projection, we have its dimension. So it would be very tempting to say that the dimension of this thing is equal to 2 to 2L squared minus the number of projections that I made. This is not only very tempting, it is also true with the caveat. What is the caveat?
Predictors are independent.
Very good. Now, it could happen that after I've done a certain number of projections, keeping projecting me doesn't do anything. I am already on the final Hilbert space. Right? They become trivial projections after a while. Not all the projections are independent, maybe. In fact, they are not, because there is one global constraint, and this is the following, that since the product of all an, so if I multiply together all these transformations, let's see what happens. Okay, so I make this product times the transformation at this site, which means I flip this spin, I flip this spin, I flip this spin, I flip this spin. As you can see, the spin in the middle is flipped twice. So I do the identity here. Then now let me do a transformation at this site. It means I flip this, I flip this, I flip this, and I flip this again. Oh, twice. Now let me do the one at this side and at this side. And so we'll flip this one, this one, this one, this one, and then this one, and this one. Okay. Sorry, no, this I had already signed. So you can see that all the spins that are inside this region are flipped twice. Only those on the boundary are flipped. So now imagine I keep going. So as I make this bubble larger and larger and larger, only on the outside I'm actually flipping spins. But then I reach the boundary conditions. I go around. There is no boundary if I use all of them. If there is no boundary, it's the identity everywhere. So the product of all an is the identity. In other words, if the product of all the AN is the identity, if I told you that all the AN but the last one have eigenvalue plus one, since the product of all of them must be the identity, so also the last one must have eigenvalue plus one. I cannot independently choose that eigenvalue anymore. So you see that the number of projections is equal to the number of these AN operators minus one. Because once I've fixed all but one of these numbers, the last one is determined. And how many AN operators we have? We have one operator per site. We have L square sites, L by L. So we have L square minus one independent projections. So this is 2 to the 2L square minus L square minus minus 1, which is 2 to the L square plus 1. So this is the dimension of the gauge invariant Hilbert space. Questions? Very good. So now that we have defined this Hilbert space and we know its dimension, we would like to find the basis in this space. And unfortunately, the computational basis is no good because we have seen that the states in the computational basis are not in here to start with. There are many states, right? This is a vector space of dimension 2 to the L squared plus 1, but it doesn't contain the computational basis. So we need to find some other degree of freedom that labels the states in a basis. So here, our degrees of freedom were the eigenvalues of sigma z, right? That's the computational basis. For every spin, we have a basis that is whether the spin is up or down. Now we are in a new vector space, and we need to find the equivalent of the Z basis. The old Z basis is not good. So we need to find an operator that labels the states in this space. Well, this operator must be invariant. Whatever is this operator, let me call it B. This is the equivalent in the total theory of sigma z. But this operator now has to be invariant under the action of AN. Why? Why it has to be invariant under the action of AN? Because if this has to label my states in H gauge, I know this means that I decide that I have a state psi b such that this is as a definite eigenvalue, right? Say plus one, okay, or minus one. But now, what happens when I do A psi? A psi is still psi, right? So the expectation value of B in this state must be the same than here. It's like when we talked about the Hamiltonian. And so, just like before, B has to commute with A. Because if B doesn't commute with A, then they would have different expectation values. So we need to find gauge invariant quantities to build a basis in H gauge. So we would require that all these B operators commute with any gauge transformation. And actually, there are two ways of building gauge invariant quantities in this theory. One is very boring, it's very trivial. Whatever you build out of sigma x operators will obviously commute with an. I could do that. But if I do that, I end up with something that is like a classical theory. And in the tutorial, you will discuss the classical gauge theory. I want to find something that is a bit more interesting than just sigma x's. So we still want to build operators B that are made of sigma z, something that is non-trivial with respect to the sigma x's that live in An, but still that commutes. So notice that this operator, so if I consider four sites in the lattice, like these four, so the four sites that are around the plaquette, we call plaquette this object, and I operate with sigma z on these four spins. So using the notation that we like, this is the product of all the spins that belong to the plaquette P of sigma z L. Notice that, and let me call this B at the plaquette P. Notice that for every P and for every N, this is true. And why is that? Because we have two possibilities. Either the plaquette and the A operator that from now on I want to call star because it's like a star are far apart, then obviously they commute. Right? These are sigma operators. When they're far apart, they commute. The only other possibility is that one of the ends is here. And then you would see that you'd have ZZ and XX. And as you know from the discussion of the Ising model, ZZ times XX commutes. Sorry, ZZ commutes with XX onto common spins. This is the reason why my global operator all X's commutes with the quantumizing Hamiltonian in the term ZZ, right? Because it overlaps with XX on two spins ZZ. So by the same token, they commute. Oh, this is very nice. Because now, again, this guy has two eigenvalues plus one and minus one, right? It squares to the identity. So these are like new spins B instead of being sigma Z. They can be plus one or minus one. But all the states that are labeled by a certain basis B are in H gauge. Because this is a gauge invariant quantity. So I could say that my states, a basis in H gauge, so H gauge, is the span of BP1, BP2, all the BPs up to the last one. But I could say this. This could be a basis in my Hilbert space. So I have a new computational basis, right? Each of these guys, for instance, a state in here is BP1 is equal plus one, BP2 is equal minus one, BPK is equal plus one. Right? And this is an orthonormal basis in this space. So what is that we need to be careful with when I say this is a basis? So definitely this is a set of orthonormal vectors. And they are in this space. So what is missing for it to be a basis in that space?
Don't span the space.
Well, we need to make sure that it spans the space. But definitely this vector span a subspace in here, right? Because each set of orthonormal vectors spans a space. And they are in here, so they span a subspace. So we need, in order to make sure that they span this, the whole space, all we need to make sure is that the number of these orthonormal vectors is equal to the dimensionality, sorry, to L squared plus one. If we have L squared plus one independent orthonormal vectors, then they are a basis. And how many do we have? Well, to start with, the BPs are only L squared. Not only, but exactly for the same reason of this property, you can see that the product of overall the plaquettes of B of P, also this is the identity. So we do not have L squared independent quantum numbers, but only L squared minus one. So in this way, we label L squared minus one basis elements in here instead of L squared plus one. So there are two states, two quantum numbers missing, right? So let me call them W1, W2. So my H gauge is the span of all these guys, of all the Bs. Let me use this notation, and two other quantum numbers that we don't know yet what they are. So once I tell you each of these BPs, if it's plus one or minus one, and two other quantum numbers, that if they're plus one or minus one, I have specified the basis element. And then every vector in H gauge is a linear combination of these basis vectors. And of course, also these two quantum numbers, exactly for the same reasons, must correspond to two new operators that are not the Bs, such that commute with AN, exactly for the same reason. Otherwise, they are not good quantum numbers in the gauge invariant Hilbert space. Okay, so we need to find them. In order to find them, let's go back to the lattice. Okay. First tentative. Imagine that instead of taking sigma z around the plaquette, I take sigma z around any closed path. And so on. What in gauge theory is called the Wilson loop, the product of your field around the loop. Our is the most simple field that you can imagine. It's the Z2 field, the field that has only two values. Do you see that also this quantity is gauge invariant? And it's exactly because of this. Either a star operator is far away from it, doesn't touch it, but if it touches it, it has to touch it in two spots. So exactly for the same reason, Wilson loops commute with the star operators. In fact, Wilson loops are all and only, apart from the trivial objects that are made with sigma x, the Wilson loops are all and only the non-trivial objects that are gauge invariant. when you study quantum field theory and you wonder why Wilson loops are the gauge invariant quantities, in a nutshell, is because of this, in the simplest possible example. Very well. Okay, but now I can build as many of these guys as I want, right? And I have other basis elements. I had the two missing. I could pick two more, and I'm done. Where's the catch?
Yeah, products of B's.
Huh?
They can be constructed out of B's.
Yes, so let me say aloud what your colleague said. Remember when we excluded the last one of the BPs from these labels was because it was not independent from the others, right? If we decide the eigenvalue of all these BPs but one, the last one is determined. So we need to make sure that when we decide the eigenvalues of all these BPs, this one is not determined, right? Well, but look at this. What happens if I take this plaquette, all the plaquettes inside here, and I multiply them with each other? Well, you see that the interior, I multiply by sigma z twice. So the interior cancels. And I find out that this Wilson loop is exactly the product of all the plaquettes inside. So once I've established the value of all these plaquettes, or the value of the Wilson loop, is not an independent quantum number. OK, so good try, but doesn't work. It's not a new quantum number. Too bad, because if I had something that is a loop, it would be gauge invariant. So we need something that is a loop, but cannot be made of plaquettes. And this seems like a contradiction, because I just showed you that it's made of plaquettes. OK, so what saves the day?
Loop is diagonal.
Huh?
You have a diagonal loop?
No. So
loop around?
You are right. So consider this loop. So this is a loop around the torus. So it's a non-contractible loop, right? It's a topologically non-trivial loop. And you can try as much as you want, but this is not the product of plaquette operators. In fact, the best thing you can do is to multiply all these plaquettes together. And if you do that, you are left with two such things. But one such thing is not the product of plaquettes. And of course, there is also this loop that is not contractible. So this is also an independent quantum number. And question for you, and what about this loop? This is also non-contractible, right? So this goes glued to this. Is it independent from all the others that I've just mentioned? No, why? Because this is equal to this one times all these plaquettes. When I do this product, the interior cancels, and then this line cancels with this, and you get that. So in fact, there are only two more quantum numbers that are this operator and this operator that now let me call them W1 or Z or W2Z that are the product of all the spins along the cut C1 or C2, where the cut C1 or C2 is these non-contractible loops of sigma ZL. Okay, so this is the basis. So now we know what are the basis of the quantum Z2 lattice gauge theory. And in the second part of, you know, in the second lecture, the one in the afternoon, you know, we did all this work just to define the Hilbert space. Now we need to find the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian will have to be gauge invariant. Because the gauge structure imposes that your Hamiltonian is gauge invariant. Otherwise, that is not an operator on H gauge. It would assign different energies to two states that are the same state. So today we'll do that, but I want to leave you with this question that you will have to answer when we meet again, and is, do you like this space? Or it's weird? Why, and if you think it's weird, why it's weird? So when we meet again, we discuss, just before the Hamiltonian, whether this construction that mathematically is very clean, whether it has some physically weirdness to it that we should not like. Okay, see you later.